I'm excited to be here because this is like my favorite thing to do in the world, is to take uncertainty and work with large groups of people or small groups of people and try to turn it into something that we can manage. So that's what we're going to do here today. And I'm just thinking about my own what I'm bringing to the conversation here. I'm obsessed with scenario planning. I got to know Kathy and Dennis back in the ACA days around scenario planning, but before that I did it right after 9/11. I was at Blue Shield of California. I did it around association health plans, all different kinds of policy back in my sort of health plan days. And since being on the consulting side, I've done it with organizations around all aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And now here we are, and we're faced with all this uncertainty, and it's a chance to take that uncertainty and lasso it into something that we can use to move forward. So when I think about 20 years ago, I remember sitting in a presentation at a conference and looking at these slides, and there was like all these unsustainable growth curve slides, and it was like, we've got to do something about this because this is a completely unsustainable path. And 20 years later, we're still at conferences, and we still see those same slides, and we're still nodding our heads saying we've got to do something about that path, right? It's depressing. And I really feel like if we don't do something about this, it's going to be desperate for our children, for our country. This is so important to me. And that's why I quit my job. I used to be with HTMS, wonderful firm. Took some time off and started my own firm in about 6 months ago with a colleague who couldn't be here because of an ear infection, but with Cheryl to try to make a difference, to try to say we want to not be part of the sharks taking the 13%, you know, the 17% of our economy that's healthcare, and trying to get our piece of that. What we want to do is figure out how to come up with solutions that are significantly always helping to solve that problem. How are we always taking costs out of the system? So even in our own practice here, it's always wanting to only do engagements that leave the client wealthier than if they hadn't hired us, or thinking of new ways to do work. So we're going to do that with scenario planning, because what this is a very low-tech, high-value tool that all executive teams can do. Many of you are probably already doing it. Is anyone doing scenario planning with your boards, executive teams, a few guys? Fantastic. So we are going to rely on you guys to help keep things going. Let's look at what we're going to do today. So we're going to start with some information on the process. Then we're going to ground ourselves with some data, because no scenario planning exercise is valuable unless it's grounded in data, because what we think we know is often different than what the facts show. We're going to do some scenario planning exercise. Then we're going to do some work with probabilities. We're actually going to look at our four scenarios, and we're going to ask all of you to vote on what you think is going to happen. And then we've got some trusty dice over here. We're going to roll the dice.
You don't need to beat the dice.
And we're going to see if we're going to beat the dice. Dennis and Kathy were at a workshop we did in Nashville about a month ago, and we did scenarios on four different market segments and rolled the dice, and we're now tracking to see what that group of executives came up with versus the dice, and I think the dice are winning. So, and then we're going to put it at scenario planning into a broader strategic planning context. How does this fit into a traditional strategic planning model? And then we're going to focus on actions, because the only reason we do this is so we can figure out what to do, right? We want to stay active in thinking about how we can move forward. So we're going to see what actions could we take across all of these scenarios, regardless of what occurs. And then hopefully we'll... that'll give you something specific to walk away with. After the session, we'll do a write-up of what we all came up with as a group, and the Health Plan Alliance will send it out, so you'll see the scenarios that we constructed, you'll see what happened with the dice, and then you can apply it in your own way. So I'm not sure how many of you heard the Michael Levitt interview on Bloomberg. It was in late January. I'm a health policy nerd. This is all I'm obsessed. So I'm embarrassed that I would think anyone has seen that interview. Anyway, but Michael Levitt said, "You have to be iterating your assumptions all the time. In every strategic plan, the first two or three pages are full of environmental assumptions. Typically, they're written once a year. Now they need to be written once a week or once a month. This is how fast this is moving, and we all know this. So." There's a big difference. What we're talking about now is a big period of uncertainty, right? And there's a really big difference between uncertainty and risk. In risk, healthcare is really, really good at managing risk. I mean, that's basically what our business is in the health insurance industry, is managing risk, right? So that's when we can attach probabilities to what we think is going to occur. It's informed with data. We're really good at this. Uncertainty is something else. Uncertainty is when we're unable to predict the future outcome and we can't really assign a meaningful probability to what's going to occur. So a lot of times the strategic planning process involves trying to put maybe a range of scenarios together. A lot of times it involves some organizations, they do sort of sensitivity forecasting. Maybe it'll be this big, or this big, our membership or our profitability, and a little bit of work on what happens with competitors. But a lot of times it doesn't deal with the uncertainties, the big sort of impacts that could that could really test an organization. So when we think about why is this so uncertain? Well, healthcare has always been a complex system. Everyone has to take a drink when someone says nobody knew. But and everyone has their own diagram for how the industry works. But we've got our own little diagram here because there are so many pieces in motion. We've got healthcare delivery here in the center, right? Then the different sources of coverage all requiring different things of this healthcare delivery system. And then we've got these external economic forces. I did not mean anything about having the arrow pointing down here. That's a total accident. But consumer expectations, advances in the technology, and the political climate, all of these together are the pieces that influence that uncertainty. We're going to ignore almost all of it today. We're just going to be dealing with this political regulatory climate because that's the thing that unites us all. When you do scenario planning with your own organization, you're going to be looking at your own regional market, your own set of competitors, all those individual things that could be happening to you. But today, we're just going to focus on politics and the individual market. So, I think for those of you who are less familiar with scenario planning, that it comes from, many people feel like they've birthed it, but it comes from a theorist named Pierre Wack, who worked at Shell Oil, and he used it as a way to manage and outstrip their competitors during the oil crisis in 1973. And then they also used scenario planning to when other oil companies were stockpiling their reserves after the Iran-Iraq war, they used it to sell off all their reserves before there was a glut, and they sort of became the success story for the value of scenario planning. So what Pierre Wack said back in 1985 is, the better approach, I believe, is to accept uncertainty, try to understand it, and make it part of our reasoning. Uncertainty today is not just an occasional temporary deviation from a reasonable predictability. It is a basic structure feature of the business environment. The method used to think about and plan for the future must be made appropriate to a changed business environment. So Pierre Wack died in 1997 at the age of 75, and I'm thinking, what would he think about what we're dealing with today in terms of pace and appropriateness, right? And so the traditional model fails when we don't know, when we are not certain what disruptive forces could hit. And also traditional planning doesn't take into account sort of that thing that no one saw coming, or some of the more innovative things that we actually like to think about, such as what are we going to do if Amazon enters the health insurance business? That's a common one we hear people talking about. How would that affect our business? Or what if physicians lose their monopoly on being the primary providers of healthcare? What happens then to our industry? Or SoFi or some other entity begins offering a compelling health insurance solution that significantly appeals to millennials, basically pulling a large group of them out of the broader risk pool. Those are things that could happen that would significantly affect our business and are often missing in a traditional a strategic planning process, but that can jump into during a scenario planning process. So we're not going to deal with those things. Today we're going to focus on the individual market, and we're going to do an accelerated version of a scenario planning process. So as when we think about how to respect uncertainty, there's sort of this high-level view of when traditional planning process that underestimates uncertainty, it can lead to strategies that don't defend against these threats or take advantage of opportunities. Or if we overestimate uncertainty, and I can tell you a lot of organizations I've talked about lately are sort of overestimating uncertainty. They're saying there's nothing we can do until we know, right? It's just so big, it's bigger than us. And what we're here to do today is to say sort of probably neither of those things are true. Here's a perspective on the left. We have plenty of scenarios in the works. We have high, medium, and low versions of our forecasts. This is one approach traditional planning, but not really dealing with uncertainty. Or there's so many variables for us. What is happening with the feds, with our state, and with our markets? We need to wait and see before we do anything. So that's sort of overestimating uncertainty. Or we could do now. What we're going to do now, which is we've worked with our executive team and our board on the various scenarios that could occur. This has led us to focus investment in areas that apply across scenarios. We are also ready to act as soon as the dust clears. And we've got a few folks that are in this position now. Boards love this stuff. It's a way to help the board feel that there's someone at the helm in the organization. So the first step we're going to do with this is to ground our exercise in data. And everyone should have here a data pack. And this is a mini data pack. If, you know, when we do this with an organization, it usually has data that includes their own organization's performance amidst, and then information on their own region, their own competitive market. What it does is ground the conversation in the true factors facing a company. What we have here is a mini version just for our conversation today. We've got some information on national healthcare spending, where the drivers are for healthcare, sources of coverage, share of spending by age and of population. Then we've got some specific data on the individual market on pre-existing conditions, the CBO analysis, federal poverty level, income, coverage in the marketplaces, premium changes in the marketplaces, and a timeline. So this is sort of like a really quick view. Hopefully it'll be helpful. You can. This is the type of thing that I would read twice on a plane. So we're not going to go through this in detail. This is actually just for all of you to use as a reference as we're going forward if you want to check out what's happening. Yeah. Yes.
This exercise? So in other words, could you take this data pack now and just replace the data with local information, or would that not be advisable, but there is such a list of things you could say, pull this data on your market and use it as background?
Yeah, it's a great question what to use in a data pack, because you don't want to just have it be this big stack of like way too much data that no one can use, right? So I would typically work with an organization to develop a data pack that's specific to them, and if it's a regional plan, as specific to their region as possible. But it's important to have some outside perspectives of national trends and also some national competitors inside that. To me, it's really valuable to have internal performance included in the data pack, so an organization can see where they're performing, where their own business is profitable, and so on. But I'm happy to provide like sample table of contents, if that would be helpful. I got to tell you, like, it's one of the funnest, when you're doing this with your own executive team, it's good to go through the data pack in a way that we won't now, because a lot of people think they know where their spending is, and they just don't. I mean, I forget. I look at this thing all the time, right? But it also sets a tone that we're here because we're doing high-level strategic planning, but we are going to stay grounded in reality. We're going to stay grounded in the data, and it's a really nice complement to like something that someone sometimes is considered like foofy, right? Strategic planning, foofy. No, data. So, so the other thing that you have here today is I hate slides, so even though I have some, I didn't print out our slides. No one wants to see my slides. I gave three just reference documents here so that you can use them for today.
No, we want your slides.
Okay. So what's in here is our diagram, and these are just here for like reference during our exercise. And then there's a scenario planning framework. I have a high-level version of up here so we can talk through what we're going to do. But I have here the Dallas special, and then in this handout it has the applied model, and this is some sort of how-to on how you might apply it to your own organization. And then the last page we're about to walk through, which is the drivers and assumptions for our work today.
We do have our slides, Nancy.
We'll send them out, yeah. We have the PDF of this and also the data pack. If anyone wants the data pack, it's available. So with the scenario planning process, typically we would spend some time framing the question. What question are we trying to answer? That's not so easy. Today, it's going to be super easy. We're going to say, what's going to happen in the individual market over the next five-year time horizon? We're giving you the question. But as an executive team, you're going to want to think about probably more than one question to work with. Then we want to gather the data to support the specific question we're trying to answer, right? And that goes into your data pack. Then we want to identify the key drivers for what we're going to, what are the key variables that are going to influence our scenarios? So if you look inside your data pack, there's a page that says drivers and assumptions. So we're assuming here, we're going to study the individual market. Here's a sample of some of the key drivers. We're looking at guaranteed issue, continuous coverage, some way to get people in the market. You could also put auto enrollment. We're looking at whether or not there's going to be any kind of enforcement of whatever mandate or not is in place. Premium support, subsidies, tax credits. I think CSR is on everyone's mind right now, right? Rating bands, 1 to 3, 1 to 5, or none, or some other variation of this. We're looking at risk adjustment. We're looking at the definition of the benefit package, benefit mandates, essential health benefits, and the state influence on those things. Here we won't be doing state as much because it's all, we're looking at all across states. The role of the exchange or the marketplace, timelines, submission dates, enrollment dates, and the role of HSAs or health accounts. This isn't a complete list, but we can add more from you all, but we'll be applying these factors to each of our four scenarios. Other non-individual market things that we'll also want to think about is whether or not there's expansion or contraction of the Medicaid market. And also the employer tax break cap, eliminating the employer tax break or adjusting the employer tax break in some way, because that'll influence the size of the individual market. So those will be variables we're looking at. And then typically, we would confirm a framework. We're looking at time and sort of different types of change here. I've actually proposed four scenarios that we work together. I'm open to changing these scenarios. This is just to kind of give us something to go with. So the four scenarios that we want to start with, we're looking at here, are status quo, which is everything stays as is. That no law changes. However, there are going to be some regulatory changes with the current law through CMS. The scenario two is potentially a big idea change, a transformative concept that stabilizes or grows markets. So something big happens that makes markets more effective, more stable, more profitable. So we've got to figure out what that is with these drivers. Scenario three is a revised version of the AHCA. So what's on the table passes. You know, we've got some more negotiations. There are some in Congress that say this is still going to happen before the end of the spring. So we'll look, if that passes, what will that mean for the individual market? And scenario four, some various large triggers occur that make the market break down. That what we see is sort of an undoing of the market that creates chaos, right? Now, yes?
So, Nancy, I'm wondering if something cuts across all of these scenarios, which is whether or not certain insurers play or don't play. And I could see that happening in any one of these four. So the introduction or the reduction of carriers in a market.
So you could say that is both. It's a great question. It's both an input and an output, right? Because it could trigger one of these scenarios, or it could also be a result of them, right? So we would want to look at the impact of each of these on the stakeholders. And Cheryl will be taking us through that exercise to say what will happen with each of these on payers, providers, employers, and consumers. In the interest of time, we'll probably only do two of these today. But the other thing to think about with these scenarios is none of these is actually the real thing, right? What actually happens is not going to precisely be one of these four things. It's going to be some amalgam. So for the exercise to have meaning, we're going to kind of do an extreme version of each of them, right? So we don't want to say, what's the most realistic way markets would slowly break down? We want to say, what are the major triggers that would kind of turn this into this set of chaos? And for that, we could take Kevin's point and say, part of this is all the large mega insurers pull out at once, right? That could be a trigger that could create this. And we can just use something like that to define the shape of this scenario, not because we think it's going to occur, but because it gives us a chance to say, if that were to occur, what would it mean and what would it do, so that now we have that as something that's manageable, right? So we can kind of take those uncertainties and just throw them in one scenario, because the goal isn't to predict, is this going to happen? It's going to say, what would we do if that would occur? Let's look at the assumptions real quick. We'll get that out of the way. We want to assume a 5-year time horizon. I'm open to 3. A lot of times these things take, by the time the regulation passes, something passes and it takes into effect into 2 years, like the implications of it are going to take some while to reach the market. We're looking at the national model. We're not looking at state level variation, so it may not apply to everyone here. And we're focusing on sort of credibly known policy alternatives as of now, right? So what we're assuming is right now there's minimal or no IRS enforcement of the mandate, potentially loosening of regulations through CMS, and unlikely play out of risk corridor obligations. Just a few examples of sort of what we know about the world today. That's enough precursor work. Should we get scenario planning? Okay, so Cheryl is gonna, we're gonna be working here together. So let's take the first scenario, the status quo. And so what we're assuming about the status quo is that we've got the current law in place. We see continued probably discussions in Congress, but no legislation passes. So we're sort of continuing to live with the ACA under the current administration. And everybody has the drivers and assumptions to reference, so the drivers. So let's hear some thoughts on any of these variables, what we think is going to, under that current status quo, what this market could start to look like. So I'm sure many of you are already starting to plan for this. What are we going to do if nothing passes? What is this going to mean for our individual market? So let's get some...
So you're looking for suggestions of what are some of the regulatory changes that we're anticipating or considering that might happen?
What could a regulatory environment look like for this market? Yes. What would you think? What would you assume?
So one example would be that there's no IRS enforcement of the mandate.
Right.
So that could be, there could be lax enforcement of some of the things that affect our underwriting.
Fantastic. Yeah.
All right. I would think that that CMS is going to grant more waivers than it has in the past, and they're going to allow more experimentation. So there's going to be a lot, even under the status quo, there's going to be more variability by state, I would say.
A lot of variability by state, which is a really big issue for national insurers, right? With that, we're probably likely to see more high-risk pools, right? Yeah.
Two things that are kind of related. One is the AV bands and the metal levels are going to, I mean, they're already proposed to broaden. And that's going to impact risk adjustment and how we fare with risk adjustment. And carriers are applying more and more resources to gaming that to their advantage.
More broader age bands. And then more pressure on... sophistication to the risk adjustment game. Is that, I thought you said age, the rating. I thought you were talking about rating. No, you're talking about AV. Okay, he's talking about AV.
So the broadening of AV and...
So it's sort of broadening... benefit design.
Right.
Well, hey, not to be contradictory, but I would think that would be a scenario. I don't think that's in law. I don't know that the regulator can change the age bands. I would think that would be a refined for
AV
actuarial value.
Can they change the actuarial by regulation? Okay, all right. Never mind. Never mind.
Gary, it's all right. You tried.
That's 99 right, one wrong.
That's right. We're not counting.
Well, and what? It's hard to keep up with, right? Because the reason the EHBs were in the original version of the American Healthcare Act is because they thought they couldn't change them, and then they're. Then there's sort of more loose interpretations of the rules, and then there's still what can the secretary do. But I think that we're looking at something over time here, which is also, if risk adjustment continues in its current form, there's more time for more parts of the industry to become sophisticated in how they manage and approach it. What do you guys think about marketplaces and the status quo?
I think it leaves the four.
You think?
Got too much subsidy money in there. Never mind. Well, it depends on how many carriers they have.
So should we assume for this one, because we want to make some stable market, which is different than the crash and burn, so perhaps for this one we should assume CSR stands?
I honestly think it'd be interesting, to your point, I'd love to watch us play out the scenario of, well, what happens if the ACA stays in its current form? Because I'm pretty sure eventually you end up with monopoly carriers in every state, and those monopoly carriers act as utilities, and you can make, I mean, it's a license to print money. As soon as you're the monopoly, you can have a silver gap strategy that makes your lowest silver level plan a $0 cost to the consumer, and you blow your company. Who doesn't want free healthcare, right? In California, they had such a big problem with it. They had to say, nope, you have to charge at least a dollar. The best scenario for ACA is that going forward, enough carriers drop out of the market that there's one left in every state, and then you control the statewide risk pool. Just food for thought.
I think that the carriers just change, in all honesty. So I've had got 200 clients. I've had three CEO meetings in the last 3 weeks, specifically around this. One is entering, believe it or not, entering. They've never done this before. I don't know that I would have necessarily gone down that path, but that's the path they're choosing. The other two are going full force expansion because they believe that enough will care drop out, right? And that they're going to be in a better place than they were. So I think the mix of carriers will change. To your point.
So change in carrier mix, and maybe let's not go all the way to single monopoly in every state, but a narrower carrier band. Would that be a good, yeah?
But doesn't it end up that the carrier with the best provider rates ends up the monopoly? So in most cases, it favors the blue. I mean, in many cases, but there are a few of them are losing money because they've exited where they were. Anyway.
So let's see. Are there any other variables you want to define for this market? We've said there's fewer in the market. We're assuming exchanges stand. We're assuming that CSRs stand. Are we going to see anything uptick in HSAs at all? Anything there we want to pay attention to? All right, so we're assuming that the status quo, the way we've defined it, you could make an argument that nothing changes in the market tanks, right? You could make a pretty good argument for that. But for this status quo version, we're assuming that things kind of limp, that there's a path where things limp along. So that's one potential scenario that things exist. How about if we actually go to scenario three next and do the next most known thing, which is the AHCA, a refined form. I have a typo here. Acha. A refined form of the AHCA passes, right? So let's talk through what would happen in the individual market there.
Premiums go up.
So for some, right? Big changes in benefit design, right? So we're seeing probably under this version, we have this word choice, which means less standardization, so a lot of variety, potentially a lot more individual confusion around what product to buy, what it means, right?
There can be some shifting of Medicare to exchange, or Medicaid to exchange, so mm-hmm. to the extent that fewer people are covered by Medicaid, does that push some more people into subsidies
and to the exchanges?
Sorry, I know, I wasn't paying attention. Sorry.
So we have in this scenario a shrinking Medicaid, which could potentially put some folks in the individual market. We also have, with less subsidies, a shrinking individual market, right? So we have contraction in insurer markets in general. The same number of insurers going after significantly fewer members, right? So that's going to hit, some people are going to lose in that scenario, right? What about the role of brokers here? I'm curious about, one of the intents, I think, of the benefit standardization was to make it simpler for people to buy coverage, and to, the much maligned broker was being less relevant there. Are there any thoughts about how brokers could in this market? Is that, or some form of aid that helps people make decisions or navigate this?
I think in the next 3 to 5 years, they remain relevant. I think there's still too much uncertainty from a personal perspective that people will still look to brokers to help them in this scenario.
Yeah. I think in this scenario, you could see brokers almost even more important, right? Because how do you figure it out, right? And yeah.
Oh, I think there'll be more uncompensated care with providers and with hospitals. So they're going to feel the pinch a lot more than they do right now.
More uncompensated care?
Yeah.
Which will put... not everything would go back to the way it was, but that's a little bit of a concern for how things were 7 or 8 years ago for hospitals. And many of you are probably in provider-affiliated systems, which put some direct personal skin there. Yeah. So in this environment, the subsidies are age-based, right? So, and they don't track with health status, right? So they're sort of young and healthy are more subsidized, and those that are older or have a health condition are less subsidized, right? So the question is does this bring enough young people into the market to help out? There's a lot of different modeling on that. This scenario includes perhaps the continuous coverage instead of guaranteed issue. And there's a lot of indicators that the continuous coverage as currently written is much weaker than guaranteed issue. So even if it's cheaper for young people to be in the market in this scenario, many may still forego because there's not really much consequence to them for doing that. And then because there's a penalty for them to get back in the market, they're unlikely to get back into the market unless they really need to because they're sick, right? Mm-hmm. So that you see a reason for young people to stay out and a deterioration of the risk pool. It's quite concerning. Yeah. I mean, we did hear from the CBO on this, that this is a stable market, that eventually insurers will figure out how to price for this market and it will stabilize. It will just be a little more expensive and a little smaller, right? That's what the CBO suggested. Yeah?
Reductions in special periods as well.
Yes, the
special enrollment
periods. Let's also note
that... Can that put under the status quo as well? Do we think we'll see...
loosening of the special enrollment periods? Tightened them, right?
Tighten. Yeah. Right.
Oh, so
they're shorter and
tightened enrollment periods for both 1 and 3. Yeah.
Right.
Quick question on the pricing. Didn't the CBO say that it would lead to higher premiums over a 3 to 5 year period, but then compared to Obamacare to reduce the premiums, I think. So there was a bell curve there, I think, correct?
So there was a trade-off there. I think the part that's hard to track around that is the premiums that are lower are on skinnier benefits, right? So it's hard to track you know, when you see all the coverage of who's covered or not, you're not, they're not really defining
right.
what that coverage includes. So yes.
No, that's true.
Yeah. So premiums stabilize. And then I think, I don't know if any of you saw the report from the actuaries, that when you take out certain benefits for choice, it doesn't necessarily lower the cost of those plans where those benefits come out very much, but it makes it really expensive then for people who want to buy plans. You know, so for instance, if you say this, you know, this benefit plan doesn't cover any cancer, right? Then it doesn't significantly reduce that, but for those that who do want to buy a plan that has cancer included, it makes it a lot more expensive,
yeah.
right? Okay. Anything else on this one?
Yeah, I'll just make a comment. I see both your two examples. Nobody's talked about clinical care. I think they're both unrealistic. You're going to have continuous, problematic quality of care that is going to increase the cost ultimately in the system. So I don't think either is realistic.
It's a fantastic point for we haven't really addressed the clinical side of it, right? But there's and that component of it was also not addressed in the CBO analysis, right?
Well, it's just the tremendous gap.
But status quo still has essential health.
Still has essential health benefits.
And still has some of those requirements, but three does not necessarily. So
it actually causes deterioration.
Does, but it. But
the refined might not.
Refined, yeah.
So if we talk about the clinical side, the counter to that, Victor, is that it starts to, especially at the regional level, promote narrow networks. And the question is, will they help keep premium lower? And is that a solution to the challenge or not? Are people not sophisticated enough? In our experience, it takes employees in the commercial market about 3+ years to really understand how to use their high deductible health plan, their narrow network well. Right? So, correct. That's my point. So in the 3 to 5 years, I think there'll be a push for more narrow networks, but actually probably under both scenarios, the question is, will they really pan out or not? And only the marketplace will tell us, right? But I think there'll be an effort to try to drive that.
So if we were to look at, I don't know what we're going to use as a proxy for continuity of care, we would probably say that there's more disruption in the third model than the first model, right, from a clinical perspective, right? So we don't want to call those even. And then I think it's a fair point to note that we would, both of those are probably driving towards narrow networks, right, because of cost, right?
Especially at the regional level.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Should we jump to... any more on those two? All right, let's jump to the big idea of change. So this is something big happens that stabilizes and grows markets.
Is this the Walmart, Amazon?
Well, we got a number
anything
to choose
goes,
from.
Huh?
What ideas do you have?
I mean, I think we've got
the Health Plan Alliance to create a national
there you go.
Regional plans and our
oh, there you go. For years. Yeah, we're going to talk about it there.
So, I mean, one crazy thought for this is Trump has been on record for years and years and years, long before his political days, and as recently in the last few months, said he believed in universal coverage. Is there a crazy scenario where, I don't know if we want to call it this one. I mean, we have to choose what we want to do for it, but one scenario is that... that there's so much the moderate Republicans can never get together with the Freedom Caucus and Trump in a goal of really trying to get something done on health care flips to the other side and works with the Democrats on some new Trump care that's universal coverage. It's a wild card, right?
It's not that wild because 72 hours later we're bombing Syria, so.
A lot of stability in that thinking.
That was
everybody would love it. It's going to be wonderful.
But I mean, seriously, Trump has gone on record. I mean, he's even said, you know, I go against Republicans. I believe we need universal coverage. He said it numerous times now before he realized how complicated it was. I want to make sure everyone's covered. So there, one possibility is that we have some kind of universal coverage.
What do you mean by talking single payer, universal. That term.
So that's a
term is extremely confusing. Are you talking about that he hooks up with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and we have single payer, or? I mean, Obamacare was universal coverage, right? Almost universal coverage. If folks would have joined, the law said you had to have coverage, right? So that's pretty much universal coverage with that little bit of sliver of folks that were exempted.
Well,
so what do you mean by universal coverage?
So this is scenario planning, right? So let's throw out a scenario.
Yeah.
So
yeah, all right. So single payer.
So let's build on
Medicare for all.
I think it was Joe's comment. So let's build on Joe's comment where perhaps you take the risk pool, the pool of patients that would fall under this individual coverage. You know, you estimate what their total spend is, and then the feds working with the states come out and say, part of Trump Care is we're going to take this whole block of patients and we're going to have one or two bidders in the state on that business. And we're going to divide it amongst those one or two payers. And you're going to get the whole lot of it at a fixed budget for a 3 to 5 year period with a certain, you know, rate of GDP, or rather, the standard rate of rise. I mean, could you go to that kind of, you talk about big idea change, that immediately stabilizes the risk pool if you've got good, you know, dollars around those patients. You give it to two players, so you're not talking about dividing it too much. And you start to play. You kind of take the Medicaid model, if you will, that a lot of states play, right, the managed Medicaid model, and apply it to this individual group.
You can also change the size of the individual group by just getting rid of the employer subsidy on premiums, right? And then you kind of have a shift where you dump everyone into the individual market with some kind of government requirement. So you get to universal coverage by creating a national individual market. Employers less and less are involved. The Medicare for all, put all insurance companies out of business, doesn't seem like that's really doable, right? So if we come up with something,
well, Medicare for all wouldn't put insurance companies out of business. It would.
But MA for all. Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't put insurance companies out of business either, because there's a lot of us in Medicare right now.
But I'm saying the Canadian model of like, let's just
Well, that would, then there would be a whole market of folks that buy additional coverage, just like in other markets. So it's just a new business line. It's right, supplemental coverage for all.
Supplemental coverage for all. Yes, Luann over here is.
There could be increased regulation of pharmaceutical companies, and prices of drugs could drop dramatically. So that could actually help all of us. But they could regulate the price of those new drugs so that they can no longer charge $1 million a year for something.
But, yeah. So are you putting it in this scenario, assuming that because everyone's in, there's a bigger purchasing power, and there's finally, achieved some of the breakthroughs on pharmaceutical negotiations?
Well, I think there could be government regulation where the government funds the pharmaceutical companies, but then in return for that, they limit how much they're allowed to charge for things.
So some scenario that
price
brings
controls,
the pricing
down. Regulations that control the price of Rx,
So we're looking at a market-based universal coverage model, right? It's not really single payer, but it's required to play kind of thing, right? So this would do to... For this, we would assume everyone's in. There's some kind of effective guaranteed issue, and there's some enforcement of it, right, in this model. We've got to get everyone in this one. Yeah?
It's a lot like Obamacare. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Well, I'm wondering if the big idea finally introduces some sort of impact or reform on the delivery side. Because we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic here with all of these payment changes. They still haven't gotten, if you don't change fundamentally the delivery side or have some impact directly on the delivery side, we're just coming up with different ways to cover people with a still broken and overcharged system, right? And we want to do it for less. That's not going to happen.
Well, perhaps this puts caps on spending that forces delivery system change.
that's what I'm thinking. I mean, we're guessing on what people in Congress will come up with for a big idea, which is a really fool's errand. But I think that, you know, that's, to me, that would be a big idea, is break outside. Our physicians said, well, what's the impact of the ACA on us? And I said, not much. You know, they're counting on insurance companies to sit on you, mm-hmm. as opposed to having any impact directly on the delivery side.
Well, this could include just having a cap on growth and federal programs. I mean, there's already a cap on the exchange subsidies beginning in 2020, but if you had a cap now on Medicare and Medicaid spending, you're stopping the growth and you're forcing the system to do with what is. I think the difference between this and Obamacare is that in this, we're assuming a disrupted different market, perhaps, with less of a fundamental role of the employers. I mean, Obamacare didn't really change the market for most people who get coverage through employers, right?
But I agree with Mary Ann. The big idea is disruption. Mm-hmm. One idea would be you decouple RVUs from compensation.
There you okay.
go. That's,
okay.
That's a big idea.
Okay. So big delivery
There'll
side disruption.
Blood on the
there
floor,
you go.
But that's a big idea.
Okay.
Another big idea would be to design a system, for example, in Japan, the entire population understands the government picks up 80%, 20% is yours, and you figure it out in the marketplace by getting the best deal that you possibly can. So there are all sorts of different approaches. It doesn't have to necessarily be a single payer. Another idea would be to have a VA system where the government says, I'm not just going to pay, I'm going to deliver the care for you, too. So these are big ideas, I think. But realistically, you know, that's a different issue.
Well, if you have Congress.
So one that could have a significant impact is, and I'm actually pitching this to some Republican lawmakers, so we'll see if they bite on it, but in Maryland, which is a bright blue state, they've had the HSCRC in place for a number of years, and essentially it establishes a one rate all payer for hospital systems. So if you think about this, all of a sudden Medicare is paying its fair share instead of 98 cents on the dollar and Medicaid instead of 60 cents on the dollar. What it does is it has the impact on employers who will see a reduction in their premiums because instead of paying effectively 250% of Medicare for their rates, they now pay 100%. And in that structure, all of our input cost would be normalized. We would have to compete not on price like Blue Cross does, right? We would actually have to compete on value and product innovation and those sorts of things. So that, I think, could actually be a very real thing. If it's framed in the idea that there's a hidden tax on business, the Republicans could easily get behind what is otherwise a bright blue state idea. So.
Interesting thought. Mm-hmm. So we've had a bunch of big ideas here that could contribute to this scenario. We'll see if some of these arise in 1332, right? We could have innovation around some of these. Okay, so in this model, what happens to exchanges or marketplaces? Are we assuming that there is still some mechanism to distribute product? And are we assuming that there's many insurers still competing?
I think we go back to this, that again, if there's a breakdown in the employer, if they change the taxes and the employers don't get a tax break for providing health care benefits, it throws everybody into an individual market. You know, that's going to impact so many of these things, so many of the things that we have to do.
People are starting to get excited about the big idea. Any other ones here before we move on?
I think the answer to your question is electronic, just because everything else that we buy, there are algorithms that, you know, answer a bunch of questions, it recommends something for you. The broker model in and of itself is it can all be automated and remove the inherent conflict of interest that brokers seem to have. So
some kind of marketplaces. It may or may not be the federal marketplace. I mean, we already have alternatives to it, right? So this could include Walmart or Amazon or somebody else or, yeah. Okay. Now let's assume a model, number four, where the market breaks down.
So one thing that may drive that is there's currently, you know, court case making its way through as to whether or not, you know, the Affordable Care Act actually has the ability to, you know, fund the the supplemental payment, right? So, you know, if it's declared that Congress actually has to vote to fund that,
What will the Freedom Caucus be on that? Will they potentially block that? How's that going to work? So, you know, perhaps they, you know, they stop funding the subsidies. That would make the whole thing break down in a hurry.
So cost-sharing subsidies do not go funded, right? What about premium subsidies?
The scary thing to Steve's point is that could happen by the end of this month, mm-hmm. right? Because the budget discussions are, mm-hmm. you know, we're
it's 20, active.
21 days, right?
And there are people who really, really want that, yes. That brings us back to Kevin's comment about would that trigger national insurers to, or many, to pull out entirely?
Yes.
And regionals. So will we say minimal participation in individual marketplaces? And without the subsidies, rates go up significantly? So the products are more expensive?
Well, the rates might be the same. There's no cost sharing.
Well, you could say if there's less cost sharing, the only people who are going to really keep staying in the market, right, are those who really need to. And that
the real cost will go up.
Yeah.
To them, but I don't know what happened to the rates.
So I think in this scenario, the rates would go up.
It would become unaffordable. And more
care. Yeah. So we see an individual market death spiral.
And we see just mass exodus from that market.
Yeah, from insurers. Yeah.
Cost shifting will occur to the other commercial markets.
Both from insurers as well as membership.
Yeah.
And so if we lose the members that we've brought in through the individual markets now and they become that much more, we have that many more uninsured people, which is kind of what CBO was saying, the impact that has on the rates for everybody else becomes.
Well, you can't charge enough at that point.
Okay. Yeah. So in this scenario, you have pretty much the dissolution of the individual market, right? So you have... you have uninsurance of a scale that's
where do those people go?
Bigger than before the ACA, right? You have some potentially. Uncompensated care goes up.
Cost shifting occurs as a result.
Cost shifting, so rates go up for employer-sponsored coverage.
Employees go through our hospital owners' ERs.
Okay. Employees go through ERs, right? You could see in this scenario some delivery side reform. You could see the expansion of urgent care, right? You could see...
you could see it there, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
doesn't it make a difference on when this happens? So some of these things that they're talking about could happen mid-contract cycle. So if they just stop funding the subsidies, you don't have the opportunity to get out at that point. So insurance companies like the ones in this room could lose considerable amount of money before you have the opportunity to just pull yourself out.
So do we...
I believe there's provisions in the law to get out mid-cycle if they fundamentally change that.
Well, plus they're not fundamentally changing anything other than just saying they're not going to put money in the bank for the subsidies. They haven't taken the subsidies away. In the law, they're just saying, well, there isn't going to be any money to pay for them. So I'm wondering if that would trigger something in a contract.
Chaos.
Well, some people are maybe want to negotiate with their insurance departments the opportunity to put cap on membership or, you know.
And also the blowback on the delivery system. I mean, we literally... You know, if it were big enough, you could see some small providers in rural counties just going out of business, not being able to continue. And we already know we have access issues in the rural counties.
So
what I wonder is, if you think about, you know, I said earlier, like one leads to four, and then four theoretically would lead to two. The question is the timing. So if it's mid-cycle, to your point, does that create so much chaos and so much angst that suddenly they have to do something, which is the big solution? I mean, when I read the ACA 7 years ago, it looked to me like it was designed, maybe intentionally or not, to fail sometime around 7 or 8 years into it, right? Because it was just a natural progression.
That was my sense of view as well.
Yeah. I mean, Exactly. So lead it up to the only logical conclusion is some new big idea. And I think the Democrats would have said single payer, and I think, you know, anyone else might have said some sort of giant marketplace or what have you. But, you know, the question is, how long does the thing last while it's breaking down? Does it get all the way there and lots of people lose money, or does it go so far it's a crisis and it forces legislation?
With the market breaking down, and also with the AHCA, we'd have decrease in continuity of care and decrease in management of chronic conditions and preventive care and worsening of outcomes and deterioration of health of the population.
Well, I think the main jobs of the departments of insurance are to prevent insolvency, so it's financial. So I think if they saw some big market downturn and a plan was losing money, they don't want to dip into the insolvency fund to fund that. I think they would give you some abilities to do things. I just my perspective that, because that's their main goal. You know, they don't want to dip into that fund. They want to prevent insurance companies from going insolvent. It's less about, I think it's a little bit less about the care of the members. It's more about the financial issues, the way I see it at least.
So you're saying that the DOIs might get creative to try to stabilize markets?
Yeah, or allow some exit potentials.
Or allow some exit,
yeah.
Okay.
Regardless of outcomes.
Okay. So in this scenario, we could potentially see, going back to state level variability, we could see very different scenarios and really different in states, right? So you could see some states go back to, you know, Massachusetts had universal coverage before. You know, you could see some states might apply for 1332 waivers, others might not. So you could see really different health markets by state. And then you might see mobility by people's health status. If you're really sick in a state that had absolutely no coverage, you might be forced to move to a state. You know, you could see interstate lines. Yes, you had something.
Yeah, I think there's actually a general political instability risk to this whole thing, wherein Tom Price, right now it seems as though there's sort of a leash on him to completely undermine what's going on in the marketplaces. But, I mean, all you have to do to screw up the marketplace is to shut down the website for a couple of days. The whole thing falls apart. But the whole thing with the Russians come up and they go through some impeachment process, then it throws this whole political chaos in where Tom Price is left. Nobody's paying attention to him. He can do whatever he wants. And that's actually probably one of my biggest concerns. Because being from Georgia, you know, I know what he's like as a legislator.
So, yeah.
Destabilize enough segments of the healthcare market that it could affect the whole economy.
A recession. I mean, we know that the last recession, a significant driver of it was medical debt, right?
Yeah. So on a more positive note.
Yeah. This is just one scenario, guys. It's just one.
You're ever the optimist.
Could it be that, you know, that we go back, though, to where we were before all of this started in a market, but with much more informed points of view. You know, nobody really paid much attention to the individual market before Obama started all of this. And now everybody's kind of gotten their toes in the individual market and got a sense of what these people's buying power is. So now do we go back and say, let's go back out into the free market with more creative plan designs that are vastly different in how much they cover, but to attract, you know, go back to underwriting, that sort of thing. But does it look a lot different now than it looked before all this started?
So that's a ray of sunshine, and perhaps in this market there are some innovators who figure out how to solve this problem, right? Direct primary care or other. So there's new solutions that emerge in this market for spot fixes, right? That help some set of people, yeah? So there's innovation, right? I mean, I think if you think of crisis as a driver of innovation, perhaps, there. What was that? Trump gets impeached. So are we putting on market breaks down Syria, Russia? Russia, Syria? Then we actually have Paul Ryan as president, right? and then we go back to AHCA, right? Well, I think she was assuming the whole administration went down. But yes, I hear you.
There's a possibility Mike Pence would just go down with Trump if there was a Russian thing.
Yeah. So so what we have here is four discrete scenarios. We know that what happens next is not going to fall into one of these buckets. But we have four ideas now of what the future might look like. Right. We've got a sort of limping along current state, a few adjustments. Right. What we didn't put in here is what if price works to strengthen the markets in the interim, right? Which could also be a version.
Wow. Yeah, I never thought about that.
Is that a reasonable expectation?
How's he going to do that?
What did you say?
It wasn't meant to be a joke, but apparently it was a joke.
Oh.
The administration could work to bolster what's wrong with the ACA and try to stabilize markets. It would be a great thing for them. They would get such a win. I drink a lot of Kool-Aid. Okay.
I think that's very arguable. I think if you go back to the beginning of the ACA, there were some of the things that I saw firsthand. One of them was Tom Scully talking about the fact that, you know, this is actually about mid-year, it's about four years ago, Scully had left the political spectrum, but it was talking about the fact that you got to remember that about half of the ACA was written by Republicans. There's a lot of Romney care in there. There's a lot. So this is not a foreign concept. And his point was, it's not that the Republicans didn't want a lot of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. It was that they didn't believe in the timing of it and the way it was being funded. So I think this concept of the status quo with tweaks and revisions probably is very realistic as a scenario. So I think, you know, what we're seeing, at least from a health plan perspective, is a stabilization of the risk pools finally, and the risk stratification and the risk payments. So we're finally starting to feel like we had a runway that was starting to make sense. So in some ways, we'd prefer to see that happen, to be quite honest with you, as would our health system, because they're getting the uninsured payment. So I think that's a very real scenario. I think people love to talk polarization, but I think the fact is there's a lot more bipartisanship behind the scenes than I think people realize. The second thing that I've shared with some people that I saw at the very beginning of the Affordable Care Act, I was at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee at the time, and was one of a handful of speakers who went to Washington to speak behind closed doors to senior staffers, House Ways and Means and Senate Finance, Commerce and Energy. And what we saw that day were senior staffers, so not the people in the front of the cameras, but the senior staffers doing the work. And this was actually the week that the Supreme Court was due to rule on the big provisions. And they were still finishing each other's sentences, trying to figure it out, Republican and Democrat senior staffers. So I think behind closed doors, away from the cameras, there's a lot more bipartisan support for the status quo than people would want to realize. Personal belief.
I mean, I actually think that if you took politics out of it and you said to most Americans, what do we want? That it would be almost everybody would want to cover everybody and not with blank government checks. I think almost everyone thinks those two things. Not everyone on the far extremes, right? So if you had a few moderates on the Republican and Democratic side saying we're going to kick party to the side and we're going to come together and propose, they would become heroes to the people. And I could see Trump being innovative.
Right.
I mean,
right. Remember, he's a moderate to begin with.
He's
really
a moderate.
Look
I could
at who
see
he
him
is.
Jumping.
So,
yeah,
absolutely. I think him going across those lines could very well happen.
So status quo, we're considering, but you could rename it though. You would have to take Obama's name out. Like it would be very similar, but it would be like reborn with a new name,
right.
Like new branding, right? But regardless, the status quo is sort of like within a certain band, right? Where we are now, we can see different versions of it, a little less, a little more. Yeah.
Well, I do think it's somewhat preposterous. There is actually evidence to what you're saying about them strengthening the markets. So SEP validations, which we've all been asking for since the beginning of the exchange markets, start in June. That was SEP validations. They're going to actually start validating SEPs. They're going to actually start restricting like the most adversely select population joining the marketplace. And that happened after the new administration was in place. So what I'm curious about, though, is does anyone actually know what Seema Verma's, you know, I kind of know what her background is, but like what's her position? She's a consultant by trade, so she doesn't have a position. Well, I know that, but like what is her... You know, do you think she wants to make it work? Because if she wants to make it work, she's got a lot of power as a bureaucrat to make it work with a few Republican ideas, which may go to somewhat what you're talking about.
I don't know. I think she's more moderate than Pence from anecdotal stuff. But, okay. So that's the status quo. The big idea is that we got a whole bunch of disruption in the delivery side and on the payment side to create universal something for everybody, right? This is like sunshine and rainbows. The AHCA passes. We have some unfortunate consequences here for a shrinking insurance market with higher premiums, right? And then the market breaks down. We've got a bunch of things that could lead to this death spiral. So this is four different scenarios. This would be different for everyone's individual state, right? But these are things that we can work with to think, what would our organization do in each of these? So why don't we take a break? Since we've been working for a while, and I'm sure people need a little break. And then we're going to come back and rate the impact of each of these scenarios on the different stakeholders, and then we're going to take our bets on them.